I'm Eleanor. I'm originally from Chicago, but I live in New York now. I go to Fordham as a grad student, and I work at WFUV, their public radio station. And I'm new to community radio and interested in community radio and working on a thesis about low-power FM and community. So that's what's brought me here. Which is also why I'm recording, which I guess I probably don't have to explain here, but very nice to meet all of you.
Well, I'm Karis. I'm a volunteer for Mickey's Radio Project and have been kind of deeply entrenched in the whole People Power Radio Project, which is the campaign that's been kind of going across the country via Promethea staffers as well as people who are in their respective towns, wherever they are, who are putting videos up on the internet in support of Promethea's Radio Project and the campaign to get low power radio legislation pushed through Congress. And I'm the one who's putting the videos on the map and making sure that everything is kind of cohesive and running well, I guess. Whatever you want to call it. If you see the map, you'll see it, and you can pull up each town and see who's made a testimonial, and it kind of just gives a visual aid and a more tangible, active, you know, level of support to the work that they're doing on a daily basis.
Great. Do you want to just start?
To support what I was talking about, these are a few videos that we've loaded up for people who've sent in or recorded with us in support of the Low Power FM campaign. Hopefully, if you can't hear it, let me know. This guy's not loaded yet, so we'll let him load, and then we'll go to another one.
All right, my name is Emery Wright. I work for Project South, Institute for the Elimination of Poverty and Genocide, and I think community radio is very important. I think community control generally, is important. We need to build and control what we need at the grassroots, and so radio, health, safety, all these things. And community radio specifically is something that we use at Project South, one, to get information out to our people, to our membership, and to the larger Atlanta and Georgia community, but two, it's a way where we can start to build community power at the grassroots. And so community radio is a piece of community power. I'm down with it. Build community radio.
Hi, my name is Rob. I'm with Media Ventures in Cincinnati, Ohio, which just also became WDQC 95.7 local radio station. It's LPFM in Cincinnati. Local radio, community radio for us is fantastic because we get to feature 150 to 200 bands locally in the community. You know, where you're not playing the top 50, you're not playing the top 40. You actually get to hear what's going on in the community. You get to interact with the bands that are running around in the venues. And you get a lot of local talk. You know, you get the opinions of people locally, not your, you know, your high-end guys. So yeah, it's a pretty awesome project for us, and the bands are excited. So, awesome.
Community radio to me means having the airways for the community to express themselves. In my situation, I found that there was hardly any history available on the airways about the LGBT community. So I decided that that was a need, because obviously a lot of people feel like they have never met anybody that's gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual. So we came up with the idea of having the Rainbow Minute, which is a one-minute radio show here at WRR, and right now it's aired three times a day. We have 100 volunteers who are readers of the Rainbow Minute. The partner and I write the text, the research it, and it's now played on over 200 radio stations worldwide.
Sorry about the background noise.
I'm Mark Kitt with WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky. And community radio, it's hard to say exactly why it's important, but it's because it's sort of like saying why it's important to have public spaces downtown, or why it's important for people to pass on the musical traditions of the area. It's not just like a way of expressing yourself, it's also a place for expressing yourself. And we know that when people have community radio, they talk about things that they wouldn't talk about in other ways. They have disagreements. sometimes on air about things that it might be hard to bring up sitting around the kitchen table. So when I think about community radio's importance, I guess I think about what it would be like without that kind of space. And so I know we need to make sure we have.
Examples of, kinds of testimonials that we've been getting. A lot of times people are outside, so you get the background noise, which is unfortunate. We're going to something to kind of edit that out if we're going to make the videos more higher quality. But generally speaking, you get the idea of how people feel, and from place to place all over the country, these videos are pretty much all mapped out. And like I said, to me, I'll show you. So that's what the map looks like. So every pinpoint we have, you click on one and it comes up and it shows you all the people there that have a video. It's a little slow to load, but look at the general idea. So it's in San Antonio, Texas, and we have several videos in the box. You can scroll down and it's a few of them. And it just is a way to have people represent, kind of shout out your neighborhood, your city, and your reasons for feeling like you need low-power radio in your community. And to me, it's way better than having a petition or anything like that, because it's real people talking to you instead of just this paper with signatures that you can throw in the trash. So,
are they on the Prometheus Radio Project website now?
The actual testimonials?
Yeah.
They're only there via the map. All the stuff that's available, and as far as video is concerned, is on YouTube. So if you click the map, the map is on the website. And if you click any of the links on the map, it'll take you to the videos which are stuck to the map.
Uh-huh.
But other than that, we don't have video directly
embedded. No, it won't be necessary. No, I see what you're doing. That's great.
Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much it. That's what I've been doing. Thank you.
Yes. Just briefly, if you wanted to say, we went around and just talked about who we were and kind of where we're from,
Sure.
I'm going to talk just real briefly about the background of where low power came from. Are people feel like they're super familiar with the history of LPFM and where it comes from, or
maybe a little bit across the board?
You are writing a thesis on it. You can jump in at any point, anyone who, but just to give some context to where we are today. I guess, I think in, the late 20th century, saw an increased amount of media consolidation with the watershed moment was the Telecommunications Act in 1996, passed under Clinton, which deregulated in a lot of ways media ownership, and people increasingly found it difficult to have access to the airwaves in both in a legal way. And so, over that time there was also an increase in unlicensed radio stations. Towards the end of the 1990s, FCC was, shutting down a lot of those stations, and people were like, we have no way to access this. Commercial stations are really expensive to run, to build, and non-commercial stations are sort of inaccessible in a lot of ways to just average, members of a community. And so what we ended up having was the FCC created low-power FM, which were 100-watt radio stations, which were free to apply, open to only a not-for-profit organization. So, that could be a local government, a school, a union, a community group, any number of things. And it was really exciting. There was this now a legal way for people across the country to have access to the airwaves, and recognizing that not everybody had the privilege when people were running private stations successfully, that people could take the risk of running an unlicensed stations, and because there were a lot of undocumented people or a lot of people that couldn't take that risk. So it was this really amazing opportunity. Shortly after the FCC created LPFM in 2000, the Congress kind of stepped in at the urging of large commercial broadcasters to put restrictions on how many LPFMs could eventually be licensed. And they did that by restricting the frequencies on which LPFMs could be licensed. So the original creation of LPFM said you could be on the third adjacent channel. So if you have a station at 100.3, you couldn't have an LPFM at 100.5 or 100.7, but you could have one at 100.9, and that would be adequate distance so that there would be no interference. However, Congress stepped in, passed this legislation called the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act, which said, no, we're going to push that to the fourth adjacent channel. So basically eviscerated LPFM in urban areas, suburban areas, and in rural areas, pitted groups against each other that were both looking for LPFM stations. And basically since that happened, Prometheus and a number of allies have been working in D.C. to repeal this legislation by passing the Local Community Radio Act, which would basically just overturn the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act, untying FCC's hands and reallowing them to license LPFMs on third adjacent channels, which would open up potentially thousands of stations across the country, and particularly in urban and suburban areas where there is not one LPFM in the top, what number? 50 markets. There's one in Richmond. So it was the Local Community Radio Act was first introduced in 2005, and again in 2007, and it never made super large amounts of progress in those two Congresses. But this year, 2009, in the 111th Congress, we made unprecedented progress. We were passed out of the House completely, and now we're working in the Senate to pass out of the Senate Commerce Committee, and now we're trying to pass out of the full Senate. And Petrie can talk a little bit more about that right now. But Congress is run on a two-year cycle, and so this is the end of the 2 years, and we have basically until the end of this year to pass this legislation, or else we have to start all over again, or whatever else might happen. That's kind of a brief overview of, LPFM.
I just have one question. I used to hear so much news about the people actually at the FCC. Mm-hmm. You always used to hear about those people. I don't know how you feel about who Obama has named, and are they just staying very out of the news a lot? I mean, I just don't know what's happening at that agency.
Take that. The people that Obama named to the FCC, one is excellent, the one that everyone was nervous about, meaning Cleburne, because no one really knew her, and so, but she's turned out to be very, very good. And then the guy that everyone really liked and thought was going to be really great has turned out to be not really doing very much. In the whole 2 years that he's been the chairman of the FCC, he has been, he's only passed like two or three items, and most FCC commission chairmen pass two or three items every month.
Wow.
And so he's been remarkably ineffective thus far. So it's kind of a very strange situation at the FCC right now.
Can anyone figure out why that's happened?
No one knows. Mm-hmm. My own theory is that Obama told him not to do anything, just because he didn't want any more trouble. Then he, Obama has his like five issues that he wants to push through, and he just doesn't, nothing in telecom is important to him. Mm-hmm. That would be my guess.
And I wonder, I don't know, I don't have a lot of experience as much working with the FCC, but I wonder if there was this expectation that Obama, under Obama, the FCC would be, really rad and do these things that, people across the country supported on, kind of the left or, more grassroots media makers, and they're as in bed with, commercial broadcasters and, not populist forms of media making as much as like the Republican administration appointees were. And so I think that it's a lot less in the news because I think that's kind of being hidden. I don't know if that makes sense, but like my immediate reaction to your question was kind of that's what I think. You know, I just think that like they're not really any better, and but they're, you know, I don't know, trying to hide it a little bit.
So a little bit more about where the legislation stands right now. So as Dion said, we passed the full House of Representatives, and we passed the Senate Commerce Committee. And right now we're in a moment where we've been put up for what's known as unanimous consent. Unanimous consent is where it's basically used for non-controversial items, like National Ice Cream Awareness Week or something like that. And but it's how the Senate does about 75 or 80% of its business, is you go through, you get an item to the point where there is no controversy whatsoever, and it doesn't require any floor time, and it just gets passed automatically. And so the process they have is they just send around an email to everyone and say, hey, we want to just put this National Ice Cream Day, you know, and pass it. Does anyone have any problem? And then any senator can put what's called a hold on any bill and say, wait a second, that either I don't know about that, or I actually think that isn't non-controversial. And so that is, that's what so far we've been doing. There have been 3 holds so far, and each time we've gone to the senator and, you know, just given them a little bit more information, and they've said, oh, well, I don't have a problem with that, and then they go away. One of the problems is that they don't have to say that they're putting a hold. It's actually a secret. And so you basically have to go to every single office and say, are you holding the Local Community Radio Act today? And even if they weren't last month, you have to go back and you have to say, okay, are you now holding the Local Community Radio Act? So it's a very deeply dysfunctional way of making decisions. So that's what we're sort of working our way through.
And I just want to jump in real quick. I realize I kind of glossed over, but I think what's been really interesting over the last 10 years is like this, the US Congress is not like Prometheus's like turf, right? Like we're not like a power player on Capitol Hill. We don't have a lot of money. We don't have a lot of like large like public influence. But what we do have is like grassroots pressure. And what we've been doing over the last 5 years mostly that has been successful in the House is like connecting grassroots people across the country that are excited about like community radio, low power radio, either run stations or want stations, and connecting them to their congresspeople and being like, hey, listen to us, I'm your constituent, I really want a low power radio station, I want you to care about this. And that works when you're like, for the most part, dealing with the House of Representatives. And we've been pretty successful, more successful than I think a lot of nonprofits in DC at mobilizing grassroots people across the country. Like we had the LPFM Leadership Days where we brought in people from across the country to do like an action and then lobby visits and like organizing in DC. And it was like a wide array of people. We had like folks from like all different kinds of people, and it was amazing to see the people that Prometheus brought together around access to radio and like media justice, and it was really rad. But what we're finding now is like in the Senate, it's a little bit, that's a little less influential, and so it's really difficult. But it is obviously still important, but I did want to highlight like how I think Prometheus did a really good job of like kind of lobbying Congress in the way that I think maybe is like one of the more like truer forms of like getting people from across the country to actually contact their own representatives and put pressure on them and like encourage them to support this legislation. But the Senate is like a whole different animal and like is steeped in like a good old boys network, and it's really difficult to fight that and to find success in it.
So the other thing that's happening now, I just talked about how the FCC has been really ineffective and everyone's been criticizing them for not doing anything. And so we do have a little bit of a problem in that the FCC all of a sudden just decided, oh, we're supposed to be passing things and moving things. And there's been this one item that's been stalled for 7 years where they were going to give away a lot of the frequencies that were available for the RFM to these things that are known as translators. And that, all of a sudden, in the past like 2 months, they've gotten very, very excited about that. And they're like, oh, we have to pass it this month. We have to pass it. And we're like, you've been waiting for 7 years to pass this thing. Why do you have to pass it now when we only have like a few weeks or a month or two before we actually might pass this out of the full Senate and it becomes law? So the past couple of weeks, we've been very focused on getting the FCC to like actually hold off and like don't decide to just suddenly give away, you know, half or actually 90. Their current plan would give away 94% of the channels that would have been available for low power FM if they just had like decided that they had to pass it this month. So that has been something that we've been working on as well, just to make sure that all this doesn't like suddenly get upended by a strange and ridiculous act by the FCC. Which, generally speaking, the FCC has been very good on this until only like 3 months ago. But now, like, because they're getting a lot of criticism for being ineffective, they're suddenly trying to like clear out all these things that have been sitting around for a long time. So,
do you explain who would they give them away to?
Well, the strange thing about low power FM is that the big complaint about low power FM was that we were going to cause all this interference to full power broadcasters. But in fact, the FCC already gives out small, low-power licenses in what are called translators. They're repeater stations, and they use a slightly different process, but they occupy the same channels, and they use the same transmitters. They get set up on the same hilltops. And so, like, according to the National Association of Broadcasters, it was going to destroy the entire electromagnetic spectrum if you gave out low-power FMs. But then, meanwhile, the FCC opened
up... On the third adjacent channel.
Yeah, on the third adjacent channel. But the FCC went ahead and opened up a window while they were waiting for this low power FM bill to pass to allow translators. And those are actually located on the second adjacent and the third adjacent up to 250 watts, and they're all over the country. And there were just... there were 15,000 applications for translators that were put out all around the country. And 4,000 of them were by one religious network based in Twin Falls, Idaho, called the Radio Assist Ministry. And so we called attention to this, and actually the FCC got really mad, and they were like, wait a second, no one was supposed to get 4,000. You're supposed to get one of these to like extend your signal from this hill to that hill. You're not supposed to build like a 4,000, you know, chain religious network out of it. And so that's why the FCC has not been doing anything about this for 7 years. But then there are some other people that are like, oh, I only applied for one translator, and I've been waiting for 7 years. Why can't you just clean this up and fix it? So the FCC is just sort of like chasing its tail right now, trying to decide what to do about kind of the mess that they created.
So basically they would allocate it to everyone other than an LPFM station.
Yeah,
that's what
basically.
It comes down to.
Or another way of thinking of it is the only people that are allowed to have these stations are people that already own another station.
Other stations.
And everyone else, like the 99.9% of the rest of the population, is told that like if you were to do the same thing that an existing broadcaster does, you would cause all this interference, you would destroy the radio band. So, so that's kind of where we are. over the next month or so, Congress will be in session, but they're all going to leave on, well, October 8th. So basically in the next 2 weeks, we're going to try to get done with the holds. We actually still have like a little bit more time that we may be able to pass the Senate that way. And if not, we'll just be like really pushing the full Senate to just find some other way of getting it done. Take it off of the non-controversial calendar, admit that it's not National Ice Cream Day. It is, you know, something that one damn senator from somewhere just will not let through for whatever reason, and you've got to just put it on something else in order to make it go through.
So. Do you have really strong allies that are 100% behind what you're doing, and who if we sort of wrote to and called and you know did whatever we could to get them to just exert their influence? I mean, it's a I know it's a very silly sort of notion, but I assume you have champions. I mean, people who really, and it sounds like the people who have had objections don't really have objections for any reason. They're just objecting, you know, just to do it. So is there a strategy? I mean, is there a way that this could get publicity in a way that, you know, if people start email, you know, sort of trains going towards people, specific people who are in your court, and letting them know how urgent it is, and that if they could call in their favors or do it. I mean, I don't know. It sounds like if it doesn't happen, who knows what the next Congress, it could be worse. I mean, it's hard to believe, but.
Yeah, there are. I mean, there are some things about the structure of the Senate that make it difficult. Senators really are not supposed to be responsive to anyone that's not in their state, that it's not contributing to them getting elected or not. So people, you know, from New York are a very limited influence on Harry Reid or someone else like in leadership. But we are really pushing for having a lot more visibility of the power family over the course of the next month or two. We're trying our best to make that visibility as nonpartisan as possible or as bipartisan as possible. And so we're going to actually be featuring a lot of the low power FM stations that have Republicans very heavily involved, that are run by churches, you know, in order to get past whoever that last Republican objector is in the Senate. And so that's one way. And then the other way is, you know, we're also trying to, you know, let people know that the Democrats, you know, while they are still in power, they should make this a priority and try to get it done.
Do you mind if we ask questions? Is that cool?
No, please.
Yeah. I'm just wondering what your experience has been with, like, building allies with religious, like, churches or religious groups. I know, just from my, like, brief research on this, it seems like that is one of the sort of groups that are, like, really in favor of this, like, on the, that are maybe a little more conservative. So I don't know if you're.
Yeah, one problem is it depends on how you think of it. It's a good thing and a bad thing. A lot of churches are very nervous about doing any form of advocacy because they think that it would put their 501c3 at risk. And so many, many churches just do not take any political positions at all. I mean, we hear about the ones that do. We hear about Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority and just a couple of them. Those are not the ones that we know. And a lot of the small local churches are just very confused about what advocacy they are allowed to do and what they can. And so we tend not to get very much help. We certainly have gotten some, and those have been very, very effective when they have moved. And they've gotten several senators, like Senator Brownback of Kansas was very responsive to a particular grassroots church in his district, you know, when he learned about it. And so when we have been effective at that, and I'd say we have been much more effective than a lot of other progressive communications media organizations at working across that divide. But, you know, it's in the like 10-15%, you know, sort of thing, not the 50%. Definitely like some of the conservative churches are not pulling half the load of like getting this bill passed. The ones that have been fantastic are the Catholics and the United Church of Christ. They have done a great deal of work. Unfortunately, they're not really conservative enough for some of the senators from Oklahoma or whatever. I mean, the Catholic Church is sort of economically liberal and liberal on war and peace, and they're conservative on abortion and homosexuality. But what, you know, what appeals to the senator from, I don't know, Oklahoma or Wyoming is someone that's conservative on everything. It has been very nice having them. The Catholics have been very effective because they are the only real swing voters. Yeah. Because Catholics sometimes vote Democrat and sometimes vote Republican, like actually everybody really, really cares about what the Catholics say. So they've been fantastic allies. And they've gone with us to many of the offices and helped out. But the super conservative churches have not been nearly as helpful, even though they get lots of votes. licenses ultimately. You know, because if you're in a very small conservative town and there just isn't anybody else, you know, then that's who applies. More questions, discussion? I mean, that's most of what we wanted to.
Well, for all the senators that have been putting holds on the act, do they give any sort of reason as to why they're against it?
They often will take some of the talking points from the National Association of Broadcasters. I mean, in fact, the National Association of Broadcasters has pretty much offered to let this go, and all they want is two tiny little concessions from us. We've already given them seven concessions in order to help it pass the House, which included all kinds of provisions against former unlicensed radio operators, drastic interference remediation techniques. I get a look out about any interference that anyone ever, like the station has to shut down within 3 minutes, and like, just crazy stuff. We knew it would never happen, so we were happy to concede this. But there are just two more teensy tiny little demands that they have. One is that anytime a low power radio station, anytime a full power station wants the channel of a low power FM station, the full power station should be able to just walk in and take it and make the low power FM turn it off. And so that's called secondary status. It's a lot like being a second class citizen. And so it actually is already the rule for low power FMs, but they want to make it a statutory requirement that the FCC cannot even do anything to try to help a low power FM find a new channel or any alternative. So that is number one. They want like any kind of the secondary status of low power FMs to be irrevocable and unchangeable even by the FCC. So that's number one demand. Number two demand is they want to make sure that we are stuck using a very archaic allocations process that basically no other form of radio services uses and dramatically limits and overprotects and keeps more of the power FM stations from going on the air. And basically, if they did that, then a good 95% of the available power FM channels would not be available for use. So those are their two tiny little concessions where they'll be fine and they'll be happy to let the low power FM bill go through. And so we basically said, you know, you're on crack, there is no way to accept these, you know, these concessions. We've already made every reasonable, you know, concession and every reasonable thing. So, and when we explain that actually to the legislative aides, they're like, oh, NAB's on crack. Why are they, what are they doing, you know?
But they're not always acting in good faith. You know, like I've had people say that to my face and like, you think that their senator is not gonna hold the bill and then they do. You know, so it's like, you feel kind of like schizophrenic at times because it's just kind of like, I feel like I just had this conversation with you and like, you totally understand why this makes sense and why the talking points you're getting from over here are absolutely like false. Yet they're, you know, like they don't care. And so it's like, even the reasons that they give are just, I don't know, it's, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
What's the deal with NPR? Why are they, what's their deal? I know they've been a little.
They've kind of ducked out, which has been kind of great. They were very opposed back in 2000, and they've been kind of a thorn in our side for many years. But in the past year and a half, we made a number of concessions in the earlier bill, and those were actually, they were ridiculous, but they were, you know, we could make them without seriously undermining the availability of the power funds, and so we did. And ever since then, they've been very quiet, and they have not used their influence to stop the bill.
But they also haven't used their influence to help, you know, which is really disappointing from a media organization that claims to, you know, like, be all about the people. You know, I don't know. I just think it was a really big shock to me when I started working at Prometheus and realized that for a long time one of the largest, like, groups working against this legislation was NPR. It, like, really made me reevaluate the media landscape. And for a long time, I listened to NPR. And I was like, oh, yeah, of course, you know, and then, but I don't know.
I hate to ask this question because it will reveal total ignorance, but when you're talking about the we in the we made concessions, who exactly is the we? who is in the position of saying, okay, we'll concede this or we won't concede this?
Prometheus.
Just Prometheus.
But drawing.
I actually had no idea. I didn't know if it was sort of a group.
There is a coalition of allies from whom, like, we draw a lot of, like, information and, like, decision-making, including, like, a national advisory board that is, like, a representative of, like, community, like, folks, media makers across the country, and then Prometheus is a board, and so, you know, we're connected to a lot of other people, mm-hmm. but at the end of the day, like, someone needs to make a decision, and a lot of these decisions just happen, like, on the fly, like, in email, and so, ultimately, it's kind of Prometheus.
So that means
that
you're the ones, like, writing the legislation?
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, yeah.
Yeah, we've drafted it. You know, and we also, when people ask for concessions, we, like, say whether it's okay with us or not.
And then do you do it, like, in partnership with a certain representative or something?
Yeah, the bills have been introduced by one member of each party in the House and in the Senate. So in the House, it was introduced by Mike Doyle, who's a representative from the Pittsburgh area of Pennsylvania, and by Lee Terry, who's from around Omaha, Nebraska, and Doyle being the Democrat, Terry the Republican, and in the Senate, it was introduced by Maria Cantwell, who's a Democrat from Washington, and John McCain, actually, from Arizona. Yeah.
Am I remembering correctly that Prometheus successfully sued the FCC at one point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did, on the media ownership issue. Yeah, I mean, this issue on the translators is one where, you know, we may need to think about doing litigation at some point. And, you know, we probably need to communicate that to the FCC that what they're about to do is very, very serious in terms of betraying, you know, the interests of the platforms.
I assume that substantiates the stature of Prometheus to be making these decisions, having successfully sued the FCC in the past for failings on their part.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, we definitely, Prometheus is looked at as the lead organization on matters of the PowerFM. It's sort of, I mean, it's very difficult, I mean, because we're not structured as like a trade association or anything like that. And the people that we're really working with, it's not people that have radio stations, it's people that would like to have radio stations. And so that's a very intangible thing. There's lots of people that would like a station, but they've often been waiting for 7 or 10 years. And so often for many of these groups, it's transformed from something they were working on to like kind of a vague dream that they're like not sure is ever gonna happen. So it's like kind of hard for us to have like the structures of like a Congress or something like that. So we just kind of do the best that we can in terms of being able to, you know, make sure that the rules are written in such a way that there will be as much opportunity as possible. I mean, our database has like 15,000 people in it, and of those, you know, many, many hundreds of them are people that at one point or another said, I want to build a radio station, I want to build it in the Bronx. Like, how do I do it? And we've told them, well, you know, there's no way you can legally do that. We're trying to pass a bill that will change that and, you know, update them. But it's like, so it's like a very hard constituency to organize in that way. I mean, we keep them all, we put them in touch with our congresspeople and whatever. But it's very difficult to have them engaged at such a level where, like, you know, they're gonna like want to go to the FCC and like try to figure out like different, you know, engineering methods or whatever that are gonna make a decision between whether there is gonna be a station available in the Bronx or not. So that's kind of our responsibility. So,
keep going. So, what is the if the third adjacent frequency issues are dropped? Legislation,
that's what we dropped, right? Okay. What would happen
in terms of urban places? Like,
what's
the forecast?
Well, we've tried not to prognosticate too much. Is that the right word?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Thanks. Because there are so many ways that it could play itself out, and we don't want people to get their hopes up and then like some little, you know, comma moved in the legislation and then all of a sudden, then, you know, this is true and this wasn't true. We've looked at where a good indication of where low power homes would be available is where translators were applied for, because basically what we're asking for is to be able to use the same rules. For example, in the New York metropolitan area, there are actually 42 groups of translators, often more than one applied for the same channel. So there were 42 different places in the New York metropolitan area where actually you could put one of these low-power translators. And theoretically, a low-power fund would also be eligible for the same thing. Now, the New York metropolitan area is not Manhattan. There was, I think, looking at that list, I saw like maybe two or three in Brooklyn and one in the Bronx, but most of them were like way out on Long Island or somewhere in New Jersey or in Connecticut or somewhere like that. So those metro areas are like, it's difficult to, you know, it's easy to get your hopes up by looking at them. Most cities, it seems like, have at least like 3 to 5 like really kind of viable frequencies, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you would get them. For every one of those frequencies, there would probably be like between 3 and 15 applicants competing for that channel. So that's, you know, just the, you know, sort of the nature of it is radio stations are incredibly valuable. They sell for tens of millions of dollars a piece. And so to get a free one, like it's basically like, you know, if you made a big posting on the web, the government is giving away free airplanes. Like, think about how many people you would be in competition with for those. And that's kind of what it'll be like, because they are free and they are, you know, available to nonprofit organizations. And so there'll be a lot that come forward.
And then how will they decide who gets it?
Well, they have a funny process that there are 3 points that you're eligible for that give you preference in that process. One is if you promise to operate 12 hours or more per day. Another, if it's 8 hours or more of locally originated programming. And the third is if you're a local organization that's been in existence for 2 years. If you get those 3 points, then you're like kind of in the running, and you're in the best kind of competitor. We'd actually like to change that process a little bit. We want to get rid of the 12-hour point, because just about anyone can be on 12 hours now. Those rules were written before automation was common, and you could just do it with a laptop or whatever. We'd like to substitute in a point that if you promise to do at least an hour of local news, or I think 7 hours of local news affairs per week, then you get a point. And we'd like a couple of other things that make it a little bit more distinction. The other thing is, if you can join up with other organizations that have applied for radio licenses, you can add your points. So if the local women's healthcare organization applies for it, and they agree to work with the public school, you know, and the library, each of those got 3 points, they can combine for 9 points and share the channel. And then they could beat out just like one church or something that didn't want to share it. So there's sharing is encouraged by the system.
So in terms of WGXC, they've been a nonprofit for way over 2 years, and is that part of the reason why they got their license?
Well, GXC went through a different process. They got what's called a full power radio license, 3,300 watts. Low powers are never more than 100. Low power is really good. If you think about it this way, here's the radio spectrum of you know, New York City. You know, there's a station, another station, another station, another station. As you go up, you know, there's one here, one there, one there. So the spectrum is less crowded. So In New York City, there's no way you can get another full power station. The spectrum is, in fact, just too crowded. What you can do is, because these circles intersect in funny ways, you can get these little cracks, and that's what a 100-watt station can fit in between. So you can manage that. What WGXC is able to do, because they're 2.5 hours north of New York City, they can actually fit in a full power license. So they're going to cover, you know, an area just as big, but it only has like 85,000 people are in the population range, even though it has a range of 35 miles. So that's why low power FM is really the real opportunity for the cities, whereas the full power window that happened 2 years ago was the best opportunity for rural areas. Ironically, a lot of where low power FM has been built has been in rural areas, and it's been a problem for the low power FMs because they don't really have as much coverage as you really need to sustain a station in a very small place. So inside a small town, it's often worked out where there is a concentrated population. And I think some of the farm worker stations are really good examples of that. But where people have trouble is, like, you know, let's say the hills of California or something, where, yeah, there's like, I don't know, there's 500 people in the downtown, but most of the people live out on the roads outside of town, and they really, you know, low power FM station just won't really work very well for them.
And like, it's interesting. I was in Clay, West Virginia, which is like in the mountains of West Virginia, and like they have this really rad low power FM station there, and it's run out of like this small trailer in the parking lot of like, you know, the grocery store or something like that. And, but like the power that they're giving off is so small, and they're in these hollers, and so, you know, it's a great idea to have this like radio station to bring the community together, but like you go over to like the over the ridge and you can't hear it, you know, and so it's like limiting. It's like really rad because it brings people together, but it's also just like it's not reliable as like a media or information sharing source.
So it reaches like all the Hatfields where the McCoys aren't hearing anything.
Yeah.
So is it kind of like the full power and the low power can work together depending on the needs of the community and kind of how everything's spaced out?
Well, I mean, full powers are great where you can get them, but they're very difficult to get. And I mean, WGXC has done something really massive here. We were able to help about 125 groups around the country to apply for full power stations. And there, you know, there were a lot more people that wanted them that couldn't get them. Also, it's quite a bit more complicated to apply for a full power station. You have to do a $3,000 interference study, and you have to hire a lawyer. There's basically no way without hiring a lawyer. And so we did our best to make it easier, but it's still not a simple thing.
I was just going to say, like, so while like a low power station in Clay, West Virginia is not maybe like the most effective thing, like there's no way that that group of people could have fundraised and like had the connections and the resources to build a full power station. And so the ability to apply for free for a low power license and run it at very, very low cost is also really incredible. And so there is a value to LPFMs in rural areas as well. The like lack of power coming from a low power station makes it a little bit limited, but it does obviously have a place.
The place where they're going to be really the best is going to be in urban neighborhoods. I mean, when, you know, certainly some low power FMs with some rural groups have managed to do really well, and there are a couple that are here, like the one from Spokane, like the one from, a lot of them have done fine, but where you actually have the population density to be able to run and fundraise and have enough of a listener base to really make it work, it's going to be urban neighborhoods. And that's why we're fighting so hard to pass the bill.
What happened 2 years ago? You were like 2 years ago, with full power stations. Was there some sort of...
2007, in the fall, there was a window. One more thing we didn't say is, when most people think of licenses from the government, they think of their driver's license, which you just like go anytime and you can get. But because there is so much demand for radio licenses, and because you're getting something like it's a free airplane, because of that, the FCC, the way they deal with licensing is they only allow licenses at a very limited time. So they open up a window for 5 days, and anything before that, they throw out, and anything after that, they throw out. They say, this is your one and only chance to get it. And so the 2007 full power window was the first time in about 15 or 20 years that they had accepted any applications for full power non-commercial stations. The low power FM windows of 2000 and 2001, that was the only time they've ever done low power. We would hope, if we pass the legislation in the next couple of months, that there would be a low power FM window coming up in the winter of 2011, you know, or early 2012.
And in 2000, when the FCC had the filing window, it was before the legislation had been passed, and so people had prepared applications for licenses thinking that they could get them on the third adjacent channel. So immediately when that legislation was passed, like half of all of the LPFM applications were just thrown out because of the legislation that Congress passed, like despite having already like prepared them and like getting ready and excited about having potentially an LPFM. So it was like really devastating.
Do you know like the numbers of how many people applied for licenses in 2000 and then 2007, how many people actually got them?
3,500 applied in 2000, 2001. About 800, well, about 1,000 permits came out, and about 800 ended up being built at low power. For full power, I think the numbers were similar. It was about 4,000 around the country. Many of them were applied for by religious networks, also a number by NPR. Of those, we worked with about 125. I think the whole public interest coalition probably applied for about 250, 300 of those. Many of the full power applications, although there were hundreds of applications, many times there was a mutually exclusive, there was a competing situation, and there were 25, 30, in one case there were 55 applicants for a single channel. And so many of those will not ultimately be granted.
And some of them are still in the air, Hollow Earth Radio outside of Seattle and Washington State, that they were trying, and they're just like, they've been in this kind of standstill for like years, and they're just waiting.
Yeah, the FCC tries to resolve the easy ones first, where there's no competitors, and then they do the ones where there are two or three competitors, and then they do the ones where there are 10 competitors, and they're still... Yeah, they're still the most complicated ones. You know, often there's a lot of wheeling and dealing, like, I will take my application out of your way if you give me $15,000, you know, that sort of thing.
So do a lot of these stations, while they're waiting to get the approval, do something similar to WGXC, where they have like an online station, just waiting for like an actual station to be built?
It depends on the group. Like some of them do, and it really works well for them. University stations, you know, will tend to do that.
Like Chicago, there's like the Chicago Independent Radio Project, CHIRP, and they've been around for like years trying to get an independent radio station in Chicago, and they just recently launched their internet radio station.
Of it depends on whether there's broadband among the people that you want to listen. I mean, a lot of people's experience of the internet is they go to the library for like an hour a week and they check their email. And so they don't listen to the radio. And so if that's the kind of population that you're trying to reach, it's like a farm worker population or something like that, then going online often isn't really very worthwhile. It's just like sort of actually just a reminder of the fact that this country is 26th in the world in broadband adoption. And that we're going nowhere fast with that, whereas countries like South Korea, well, everyone has like much faster connections than, you know. And so places like that, you know, totally makes sense to go online because it is just as accessible as radio. The problem is, right now I'm kind of writing this thing, the president of NPR about 4 months ago made a big headlines because she said, well, in 10 years we won't be using the antennas anyway, and it's all going to be online. And this prompted like all kinds of, you know, just guffaws from all these radio engineers everywhere, because When you look at the problems that this country is having with broadband adoption, you just realize there's no way. There was one guy from a public radio station in California who said, we have a single 250-watt transmitter on top of Mount Wilson that reaches 17 million potential listeners. If we were to serve like 1% of those, like which is our audience share, that would be like 5 times our annual budget just to pay for all the servers and the computers and the bandwidth and the intellectual property and like all the other things. So while streaming is great if you're serving 50 listeners or 100 listeners, FM for the foreseeable future is going to be the way to reach mass audiences. And just because of, you know, people are so focused on like the potential of the technology, which is fantastic, but they don't really understand the scale of the implementation that's involved. And they don't understand the privilege of the relatively few in this country that really actually have true broadband and the ability to use it. It's not, you know, it's just far from the first technology somewhere. The other thing about it is that people are only really starting to realize is that one thing that's great about FM radio is it is not creepy like Google. It's just really like when you listen to FM, nobody knows you're listening to it except for you. And there aren't going to be like pop-up ads that are like, oh, I hear that you're listening to MIA right now. Wouldn't you like to buy her CD? And I think that as people start to realize that just how far the internet has gone in terms of violation of privacy, people are going to start to like realize, wait a second, like, wouldn't it be nice to just be able to listen to something and have nobody particularly know that I did that? So I think that's going to, you know, come into play a little bit more over the coming years as the internet gets creepier and creepier. The other problem, of course, with the internet, at this point, there's an enormous battle over what's called net neutrality. And net neutrality is the ability of Comcast or Verizon or whoever to choose which websites work with your computer and which ones don't. Which ones run very slow. I mean, basically, the internet as we have it, sure, it's fine. No one's going to take that away, literally. But as the internet develops new features, and as more of the internet is experienced over mobile phones, we're going to be in a position where, yeah, you're going to be able to smell over your phone, you know, or whatever. And the only sites that work that way are going to be the ones that that pay special extra money to Comcast. And so a lot of, you know, unless something very serious is done by the FCC in the next year or so, we're going to see an internet that is much, much more like cable television than it is like the internet that we know right now. And there were lots and lots of geeks in the early 90s that were like, oh my God, the internet, it's like the perfect medium, it's uncensorable. There's no way you could do anything that would stop the internet from being perfectly free. And it's nonsense. And you know, if people don't do something about net neutrality, that is going to be the internet that we have. It's going to look very much like your Comcast cable service within 5-7 years from now.
Curious what your opinion is on so one of the, like you talked about, like the ways that people can apply for a LoPAR license, and one of the things that makes them like a more desirable candidate is if they're an organization that's been around for a while. I'm curious about like talking about low power radio in terms of organizations and like social service organizations or advocacy organizations as opposed to like radio producers. And it's kind of interesting, like this idea that you want to have like an organization that's already set up that would have a radio station, which is great because they have a constituency and they have community. But like, it's kind of a really different idea than like having a radio station that is like filled with like radio producers or something like that doesn't have a social service or an advocacy organization. I don't know if you. I'm just curious about like what you think about that. Like,
yeah, we've worked with a lot of both. I mean, usually I mean, the structure of the regulations of the FCC is to encourage groups that have already existed for 2 years, but they could be anything. They could be an arts organization, they could be a youth group, they could be a union, they could be all sorts of things. So Prometheus has a particular focus on social justice organizations. And so that's what we tend to talk about a lot. But I mean, working with WGXC, WGXC is primarily a transmission arts organization in its origin. In getting a full power license, they realized that they would have to like reach wider audiences and have more uses. So yes, they will have a bunch of radio art, you know, for a number of hours a week, but then they're also going to do just like all kinds of programming for different, you know, members of the community around here. So what we usually find is that when groups start a radio station, they're often like really just thinking about the message that they're going to try to do, but they quickly realize that running a radio station is a big job and you need all kinds of people involved, and so they tend to open doors wider and just sort of, you know, they attract the person that wants to do the fantasy football review show and the paranormal hour and like, you know, just like every, you know, the surf klezmer music show and everything. So they tend to open up quite a bit wider.
Is there some kind of way that low power stations that are in different parts of the country can know about each other's programming and possibly use each, you know, when it's not a specifically local issue? Is there some, like a clearinghouse or some way that they can borrow from each other to?
Yeah, I mean, Prometheus runs like a, or hosts, I guess, the isn't there, not Stubblefield, but like, isn't there that listserv that Prometheus
would have? There's another one, there's the Grassroots Radio Coalition.
Oh, also. Yeah.
Yeah. There's the Grassroots Radio Coalition. There's also a project called, there's Free Speech Radio News, which takes produced audio from all the different stations across the country. There's a project called Sprouts through Pacifica, where different stations take a turn producing this show that they all carry. There are a number of initiatives like that. One thing that we haven't done, which often people ask about, is we haven't really organized like a federation of the stations, because there's already a National Federation of Community Broadcasters. So we would encourage people to join that. Because just because you have a low power license does not really, you know, one group could be a church and one group could be a highway authority and one group could be a union. And so we've encouraged people to join organizations that fit their content and the style of their organization rather than their type of license. And so that's why, you know, even though we're best known for doing low power, we work with 125 groups on full power stations, and we think WGXC has much more in common with that station over, you know, 30 miles away in Massachusetts, in Great Barrington, or the one in Northampton, even though they're both low power and this is full power, they have the same ethos and the same programming goals and connection, as opposed to like, yeah, there's probably like another low power station that's closer to the Northampton station, but it's probably just like an evangelical repeater station or something.
Kind of like what Cassie, right, was asking. I'm wondering about the idea of like amateur versus professionalism in low power stations. Like, how important is it to sound like a professional radio station, or is it more about getting out their message and having their own voice?
They all take different approaches. Yeah. Like, some of them, it depends on who starts the station, and there are a lot of people that have a background in radio that are really fixated on that, and they really want the station to sound really, really good. And so some of them, there's like a weird constituency of about 20 or 30 guys that they actually had jobs in commercial radio, and somehow they got LPFM licenses, and they're like just in like different parts of the country, and they basically run them almost as if they're a commercial station. So they sound very professional. They sound kind of corny to me, but you know, they're like super produced and all that.
I mean, I was a DJ on like a low power FM station, and like I like got trained for like two sessions, and then I was on the air and had like a new show and like a music show, and like, you know, I felt like I could use a little more training, but I also was really excited to feel like empowered to just go in there and be like, wow, I'm gonna produce my own new show, like I've never done this before and I can just do it. And like I felt somewhat supported or like challenged by the idea, which made me kind of excited. So, but I think like professionalization, to the extent that it like alienates people and makes it like inaccessible, or makes the whole training program so daunting that like people don't want to get involved, like in my head is kind of like, ugh, you know. But I do like the idea of like leadership development and like training and like giving people the skills that they need in order to like adequately express what they want to express, and like to not go on the radio and like not be taken seriously because they don't know how to use the equipment or don't know exactly what to do. So I think there's a balance in my head. And also, like, if you're someone who's at a station that has those skills, like at the station, I would talk to the lady who had a show after me, who used to be a commercial, you know, broadcaster. Like, I'd ask her questions because I wanted to know how to do more things, and I think that those people have a responsibility in those spaces to kind of like share their knowledge, but like that there's like kind of a low base of like involvement, and like at least that's my belief in terms of like running a good station. But I know people aren't all over the place on that.
There's also that famous send-up of Saturday Night Live of an NPR station, which of course is supposed to be more professional. And it does sound like a lot of NPR stations as you go through the country. So professionalism is in the eye of the beholder.
Anything else? Other questions? Discussion?
Thank you.
If y'all have any questions rest of the weekend, I'm happy to talk or want to know more about the legislation, about the power like, that you don't already know, because you seem like a very well-informed group of people. But
don't cross your fingers.
Well, your explanation of the third point over and fourth point over was clearer than anything that I had ever heard.
What are you saying? For my own call.
Clearer than anything ever. I really understood for the first time.
Good. Well, I have to explain it to like young, out of college, like legislative aides in Congress, and you know, I really got it down.
Can I draw a lot of pictures?
Yes. Yeah. And I even like ask them, I'm like, so what's your favorite station back home? You know, and they'd be like, oh, Power 99.3. And so I'd be like, okay, so Power 99.3 is like here. Like, draw it out for them, because it's really confusing. The first time I was explaining it, I was like, what? I don't get it, you know. But, yeah. And that's what's hard about like media policy, you know, and all of this stuff. It's like there's like a high barrier to entry of like understanding and like being involved in this. It took me like 6 months to like really understand, and I still, there's a lot I don't know, and so it's hard, it's intimidating, especially as a woman too, like in Congress, like meeting with like telecom dudes that are like, you know, been doing like telecom law for years, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I swear there's no interference, believe me.
But don't you have the study? I mean,
yeah,
there is
yeah,
a study,
yeah.
Right?
We do, but it's
the engineer
still
study.
Just like sometimes, you know, daunting. But.
And you actually have another workshop that you're starting in a very few minutes.
Yeah, what time is it?
It's soon. 2:30. Yeah.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.